right, as James finishes up his teaching on the tongue, he's going to give us about three different parables. Of course, parables are valuable because they help us to interface physical things and see spiritual realities. So hopefully, by now, whenever you see someone sowing regular seed, what do you think about because of the parable of the sower?
Sowing the gospel.
You think about sowing the gospel. And so now, whenever you see a tamed animal, hopefully, what will we think about? We'll think about the tongue. It's just another way God is trying to help us. He started this whole subject back in chapter 1 when he said, if you don't bridle the tongue, what does that mean? Religion is vain. It's empty. It's worthless. And that's one of the stronger statements in the scriptures about something that can completely nullify all the good works that we're doing. And there are several things that can do that. But this one is very important. And so he has spent the last six verses, which I'm not going to go over with. I do want to finish this section and get into the next section tonight. But we want to talk a little bit about these animals. So in verse 7, every kind of beast and bird, of reptile and creature of the sea, is tamed and has been tamed by mankind. So when did men start figuring this stuff out? See, we think we're the ones that figured it all out, but actually, when was it already figured out? Well, they already knew it then, so it had to go back further than that. And he makes it very clear that when God created man, of course, what does Genesis 1:27 say? 1:26 and 27 say about the relationship between humanity and animals?
God gave them dominion.
Okay, we have dominion, right? Now, did we lose a little bit of that dominion? If you see a wild animal out in the wild and it's a lion or a poisonous serpent, do you run away? You say, I've got dominion. I've nothing for me to be afraid of. No, that dominion was modified by what? By sin and God's subsequent curse, which over the years I've kind of grown to understand that I think what God did with the material creation is he basically made it so it could have parables. In other words, all of the terrible things we brought in emotionally and spiritually and in the realm of wickedness and evil and man's cruelty to man, what did he do with the physical creation? Kind of reflects it, doesn't it? In other words, all the terrible things that men do to man and all the terrible things that are in the spiritual realm. So when Jesus comes along, he's got all kinds of things now that he can use for parables. So, and I think poison is probably a good example of that. We've read before in Genesis chapter 1 that what did all of the serpents and all of the animals eat? What did God give them for food?
Plants.
Gave them plants. So do you need poison to eat plants? Not too likely. So I don't know what Adam and Eve saw. You know, there's a lot of question about that, whether they actually saw the animals get the claws and get the fangs and get the terrible things, or whether God created them. No, it all depends on his foreknowledge, right? If he knew Adam and Eve were going to sin, then what did he probably do with the animals? Just made them the way they are. But it would have been just as easy for God to change them. But we know after the curse that God did some terrible things, because in Genesis 1, everything that he had made was what?
Very good.
Very good. But in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, it's all vanity, empty, of no value. So God twisted and corrupted and changed things. Why? Well, we'll have to ask him that on the judgment day. But as I say, I think that it's very helpful to us because of these kinds of things. So we have the taming of these animals, but are you ever really comfortable as you're watching that guy stick his head in the mouth of a lion? I mean, don't you realize what could happen if he decides to chomp down? And every once in a while, do they? Yeah, every once in a while we read about that. And so they've been tamed, but their basic nature is still what he talks about in the next verse, and that is unruly and restless. So when we see these circus animals, or we see these animals at the aquarium, what does he say? Birds, beasts and birds, reptiles, and creatures of the sea. So we've all seen it. Guy has a falcon on his wrist, and what does he do? Throws the falcon up, and the falcon gets the bird, and does he eat it? No, he brings it back. They've been trained. And we've all seen the guy playing the pipe, and what comes out of the bucket? Big cobra or something, and he's able to tame it. And so But in spite of all of that, we know those animals are still dangerous. And so how do you act around these animals, even though they're tamed? Even the trainers, how do they act? See, they know. They have to be trained. You have to be careful. But what about the tongue? You can't even tame the tongue. I mean, it's bad enough with animals. If you've got a tamed animal and that's in your home, there's still certain things you don't want to do, and you still have to be wary of it. But what about the tongue? You've always got to be wary with the tongue. And so it's just a parable. It's a parable comparing the animals that have been tamed and yet are still dangerous and the tongue, which is dangerous, but it can't be tamed. So we think we've got it under control. What does God say? You don't. You don't. You have to bridle your tongue. You have to watch it. It has to be. It is the most dangerous member of your body. Now, a lot of stuff goes on inside of the heart, and that never comes out into the open. What does the tongue do? See, the tongue brings it out where it can bring catastrophic results. And sometimes the catastrophic results are somebody else, and sometimes they're us. They can be our reputation. And so no one can tame the tongue. So the fall into sin brought about a set of beings. And we talked about this a little bit last week with fire. Now we're going to talk about it again with poison. What's the difference between fire and poison?
The way that they destroy things.
Okay, well, the way they destroy things, yeah. There are, if a serpent bites a rock, what's a rock going to do? In other words, they're stable. There are stable things. A serpent could bite a tree. A serpent could bite. But if it bites into flesh, now what is that poison going to do? Because flesh is unstable. Flesh doesn't have stability. Life is very fragile in the flesh. And so if certain things are injected into the body, what's going to happen? See, physiological changes are going to occur. And we've talked about this before. I looked up a definition today. I don't know if I could find it quickly enough or not. But, there it is. The fourth transmission. The fourth paragraph down where it says, this is what makes the contrast so fearful. The deadly poisons of serpents do terrible things to the human body. Now, this is a quote that I got off the internet. Some block nerve transition. Others intervene with the beating rhythm of the heart. Some break down muscle tissue or cause blood vessels to suddenly become leaky and the victim bleeds to death. So those are the four basic types of venom and what it'll do. It'll either cause necrosis and you might lose your hand, or it will go on to into your brain and your heart and the heart will stop beating, or you'll start bleeding out of your eyes and your certain parts of your body. So it's terrible. But why did they have that? Why does serpent venom do that? Because of the curse, right? Because of the curse. Now, again, serpent venom is a perfect illustration of what the tongue does to emotion, and what the tongue does to loyalty, and what the tongue does to love, and what the tongue can do to other very precious things, like my flesh is precious and my life is precious. When those words come out, they do what the poison can do. And not only that, look at that next verse, that next clause on the first page. The term restless means unstable, inconstant, or restless. Now, that's what animals are when they're in the wild. What about the tongue? It's always like that. You can't trust your tongue. Your tongue is worse than a lion. It's worse than a serpent. It's worse than anything that man has ever tamed. Do not take it for granted. Do not leave it to just to whatever it wants to do, whatever the mind wants to say. Let me read this paragraph at the top of page 2. The biggest part of the problem centers on the instability of our own emotions and the unstable nature of the heart that controls the tongue. We don't always feel the same way, and therefore our communications with others, they're not always the same. If I'm angry, what kind of words come out? different words, right, than if I'm not angry. If I'm vengeful, if I'm bitter, then those kind of words come out. If I'm having doubts, if a preacher gets up and starts preaching a sermon when he's in the middle of one of his big doubts, what could come out? Things that should never come out. Things that, and that's the problem. With every emotion comes a different shade of use of the tongue. With every temptation comes a different shade of use for the tongue. With every attitude, with every conviction, as we go through our lives, and it's kind of like, remember that psalmist, Psalm 73, said, if I had spoken like this, what would I have been? Untrue to my generation. In other words, there's certain things you don't say. What about Job's three friends? He was doing fine. If they hadn't come, we probably wouldn't have a book of Job. He probably would have got through it fine, but they undermined his confidence. They put some, they injected some doubt into his heart, and they were able to do what the devil was not able to do, and that is they were able to get him to say some things about God that he would have never said if they hadn't set him up with some of their reasonings and made him mad and made him irritated and got him more depressed. And so this is what we have to understand, is that our tongue is, well, think about it like this. If what does Jesus say? It'd be better for you to do this than to cause one of these little ones to stumble. What was it he said you'd be better to do?
Put a millstone around your neck.
Yeah. Tie a rope around your neck, tie a rope, the other end of the rope to the millstone, row out into the middle of the lake, and then what? Just throw that thing over the sea. Okay, I mean, that's a pretty graphic thought, isn't it, to think about? And yet, if my tongue causes someone else to stumble, what does God say? It'd be better. So, what's the point? Well, the point is that we are trying in every possible way to get afraid, to be afraid of our tongue, to be more cautious about what we say. We saw this in our very first class. I didn't keep repeating the verses because there's no point to it. They're in the notes now. But you remember all those verses on let your words be few and be very careful. You're walking in the presence of God, and don't be rash with what you say, because God's in heaven and you're on earth. And what's God doing with everything you say? It's writing it all down. It's in the book. And what does Jesus say in Matthew 12? You can give an account. You have to explain. Why did you say that? Wouldn't you rather not say it than have to give an account? So these are all the things that he's trying to do here. Okay, so full of deadly poison. You look at those verses at the bottom of page 2. They sharpen their tongues as a serpent. Poison of a viper is under their lips. And then, of course, that pretty much is quoted in Romans 3, except the throat is an open tomb is added to it. But the poison of asps is under their lips. And then Psalm 64, who have sharpened their tongue like a sword and aimed bitter speech as their arrow. And then, of course, the last one, your tongue devises destruction like a sharp razor. You all love words that devour, O deceitful tongue. And, of course, most of us are not in situations where we have to hear this kind of talk, because most Christians control themselves even when they're angry. They're not using the vile, filthy, disgusting kinds of language and cutting kind of language. Now, that doesn't mean we don't say anything cutting, but most Christians have really controlled a lot of this, and they don't have the kind of cursing that we're going to read about in the next verse. So, we have to be careful, because we're going to have to give an account. And it's a whole lot better to go back and apologize to the person than leave that sit. Because if you apologize, you've repented and confessed. And if you take that to God, now it's gone. What if you just take it to God, but you don't go back to the person?
It's not taken care of fully.
Is that fully taken care of? You got half of it covered. You talked to God about it. What about the person? And what does God say about that? What did Jesus say about that in the Sermon on the Mount? If you remember that your brother has something against you,
go to your brother.
Okay, so I repented to God, but I didn't get to him. Well, of course, if the scriptures are being followed, what does Jesus say about that in Matthew 18? If you sin against me and you tell God you're sorry, but you never quite get to me, what's my responsibility? If your brother sins against you, Go show him his fault. Oh, you know, Alan, I'm really sorry. I repented of that a long time ago. Oh, okay, well, thanks for letting me know. That's really, really good of you. Would have been nice for you to come to me so I didn't have to do this. And but at the same time, it gives you, what if the guy says, well, I never did repent of it? Well, then we go step one, step two, step three. All right, so in verse 9, he is going to deal with the inconsistency of blessing God, but cursing our fellow man. I don't think we have to say too much about the blessing God part, so let's go ahead and skip to page 3, and let's just talk about this cursing. If you look at the definition of the term, in English, when we say the word curse, we usually think about what?
Swear.
Yeah, swearing. That's not what this word means. This is to doom or imprecate or curse, to call down curses upon, to pray that he may perish, to curse, so to utter imprecations. Now, we have two examples of this in the scriptures. You remember where Jesus says, if you call your brother Raca or moron or moros, what does Jesus say? If you call him Raca, you fool, you idiot, you jerk, you stupid jerk, what does Jesus say? That is guilty. See, if you're angry with your brother, you're guilty of the council. But if you say you fool, if you say Raca, what are you guilty of? Okay, the Supreme Court. What if you say moron, morose?
Hellfire.
All right, hellfire. So when you start cursing people, which means calling them names of derision and stupidity. But there's a worse one than that, and of course that is calling down God to condemn. And we have what we consider to be one of the worst swear words, where that's what we do, right? When you talk about God damning someone, that is the curse that's being described here when you say things like that, Brian.
Kind of reminds you of Balaam and Balak, right? You want them to curse Israel and say all these.
Exactly. Things. Bring down a curse on Israel. Bring down a curse. Now, it's interesting. Our culture, we don't do a lot of that. I mean, when's the last time you asked God to curse somebody? We're kind of smart enough to know. As a matter of fact, what did the proverb say? If you are happy when your enemy falls, what might God do?
He might not do it.
He might reverse his judgment because he saw what it was doing to you. So we're smart enough, generally, not to do this. But as I say, Jesus brought it up just a little bit when he said, when you start calling them terms of derision, you're getting too close to it. Ken?
Yeah, the sons of thunder, the two apostles, I mean, kind of surprising they were kind of getting there.
Well, that's because the Jews were a pretty hard-hearted bunch. They really were. What did they do to Jesus on the cross?
Well,
so they were cursing even there. You know, you're cursed of God. That's why you're here. So, yeah, it's like I said, sometimes you read things in the Bible that's a real serious character flaw that we all have to work on, and every once in a while we read something like this where we say, well, this one I didn't go down too far. I'm not, generally speaking, no matter how mad I get, I don't call down curses from God on somebody. I don't use that terrible three-letter word that so many people use today. And so that, I guess, we could thank God for, but we got more than enough with the tongue to worry about. But this is something that's done a lot. I've been reading about it, and you've been reading about it. The anti-Semitism has just grown and grown and grown. And what are people calling these people? Just the most terrible things. And they're bringing their own curses down. The Muslims want to curse the Jews, and it just goes on and on and on. All right. So then, verse 10: out of the same mouth proceed blessings and cursings. And he just makes a very basic statement, and that is, that shouldn't happen. That shouldn't happen. Kind of an interesting word here. I'm not going to spend too much time on it. You can see that definition toward the bottom of the page. This is a word for destiny. This is the word they use back in the Greek language. I don't know if you know this or not, but there was a religion about destiny. And this was a way that some people, and they talked about fate, and they talked about what was necessary or what must happen or will happen. And then, again, that last definition there just before Little and Scott is fate or destiny. So, but what does James say? It's not fated. It's not destiny. This shouldn't happen. This is not part of what should be. Now, I don't know if that's what they were saying like then. You remember the Corinthians, what were they saying about sexual immorality? Meats for the belly?
Belly for the meats.
Belly for meats. I mean, we got a proverb for this, Paul. What does Paul say? That's not a very good proverb. It's false. Body's for the Lord, not meat for the belly. So here, it's not something that we are destined for. This is not something that should happen. It's not normal. It shouldn't be like this. It's not right for people to use their mouth to disdain and deprecate or imprecate or bring down curses and then bless God. So that shouldn't be then. Then, starting in verse 11, we get two more parables quickly. Does a spring send forth fresh water and bitter from the same opening? Can that ever happen? No. So your tongue, people are counting. Well, take Jesus, for example. Jesus, his words were soothing, they were comforting, they were peace, they were righteous, they were godly. What could we not expect from Jesus? What else could have come out of his mouth? Nothing. You're not going to get cursing out of his mouth. You're not going to get anything negative out of his mouth. Because that's how it ought to be. Now, we created a new norm, right? We're the ones that have created this. It's normal for me to be like this. Well, why is it normal for you to be like this? Because you have this history going all the way back to Adam. The flesh has gotten hold of you, but it's not normal at all. We're going to deal with this in the next section, too, when he talks about wisdom. Because as we're growing up in the world, we learn the wisest ways to get what we want. Sometimes they're sinful. And those are things we have to go back now and take a look at and say, okay, I'm really good at this. I am really good at using jokes to cut people down. I was an expert at that as I was growing up. I was just really good at it. But I had to quit even joking at all, because what's the good of being good at that? And hurting people's feelings with jokes. And you might have heard me do it. I slip up every once in a while. I try not to. But it's just, when I see something, I can automatically turn it into a joke. Whenever I see something negative about you, I'm really good at turning it into a joke to embarrass you. Because I tell you, I was really good at it. What's the good of that? What kind of wisdom is that? You say, oh, what are you good at, Al? Wow, I can make you feel really bad with jokes. You say, well, I think maybe you better find another way. Jack?
I'm glad you mentioned that. Because I have to admit, I'm pretty good at it, too. And it's something I'm going to have to watch. But I have another question. Back up here where we're talking about fate and destiny, I'd like to hear what you say about the comment, I guess you could call it a proverb, what goes around comes around. Does that fall in that category?
Well, I don't see that in the script. Well, I guess you could say you reap what you sow, and say that's where it's coming from. But what do we say about using Bible terms for Bible things? So if I'm up there preaching, I'm going to say, God is not mocked. Whatsoever a man sows, he will not reap. I will not use what goes around comes around. Because, yeah, that comes from a source that I'm not particularly happy with, because that is a religion, and you can hear it. I've been watching Korean shows. They talk about fate all the time because they believe in Buddhism, they believe in reincarnation, and that what you've got right now is because of what you did in a previous life, and what you're doing now is going to determine how you live the next life. And we have to be very careful not to buy in or use any of those terms. So that's all I was referring to. Is that enough, or was there something else?
No, that's fine.
Okay. I remember when I was in Orville, and somebody introduced the "oh well." Whenever something bad happened to somebody, just say "oh well." And I got called pretty quickly. Don't do that. Why not?
It's like you don't care.
Yeah. Don't you care? And oh, well, nothing we can do about it. Well, why not? We can do things. We got God. We got prayer. Well, there's things we can do. Don't use terms like that. So, yeah, you have to be careful with these cliches. Ray, do you have your hand up?
I was just going to say they call it good karma and bad karma. What comes around is a karma.
I don't understand
this term karma. If you do this, if someone's going to do the first thing, and then you realize something.
Yeah, the only thing I know about karma is that Beatles song they sang many, many years ago, Instant Karma is going to get you, but I never did know what it meant. But, yeah, we have to be careful with terms like this. We have to be careful with using these kind of terms to justify things that can't be justified. Charles?
Yeah, a lot of, I guess what you would call, when people are talking, they are saying things that probably may be offensive, and maybe they don't realize that, because maybe they have heard other people do that, or say things, and to maybe some people it may be offensive to use some terminology. And it may make sense to them, but to the individual that you're talking to, it may not make a whole lot of sense to them because you're not used to that terminology. That's why one of the reasons why, and I don't mean any harm, but I don't really hardly like to joke about a lot of things because a lot of times people get comfortable with those type of jokes. That's really not a joke to me.
Right.
And I would just be upfront and honest with you about whatever we're talking about.
Sure.
Let's just talk. You and I, let's just talk. Because when we start using the slangs or whatever, and it may not be that I may not be comfortable with that.
Everybody
may not feel the same way,
That's one of my favorite proverbs. As a man who throws firebrands, arrows, and death, as the man who deceives his neighbor and says, I was only joking. I was only kidding.
Yeah, right.
And then there's another one similar to that. And like I say, that's using jokes to cut people and to hurt people and to use jokes. A lot of funny jokes are at other people's expense. It's just sad that's the case, but it is. And I find it hilarious, but what about the guy who's getting the expense? How does he find it? He doesn't appreciate it quite so much, but I'd love to tell you this funny thing about Rob. It'll just make him real embarrassed, but I wouldn't do it because it's not right. But it'd be funny. Everybody'd be laughing, but Rob wouldn't be laughing, and he might never forget it. And that's how it was. And we were terrible. As a bunch of kids growing up, we were terrible at that. We were just constantly doing that. Anyway, let's move on. Rob, I was only kidding, Rob. I'm only kidding.
Well, I don't know what you're referencing anyway. So.
Yeah, well, I don't either. I was just making it up.
It is a good discussion to stop and think about what you're saying. Somebody at work told me once that sarcasm is what people really feel about you, but they just don't want to tell you. But they'll be sarcastic about it. So that's just another way of, and I don't know, that's probably not really biblical as such, but
right.
it is, like you're saying, joking or being sarcastic or whatever. Think about how the person you're speaking to is going to receive what you're saying.
Right. No, and that's right. And so when we're joking, the jokes need to be uplifting. They don't need to be at anyone else's expense. And they don't need to have any, how did Paul put it? Foolish jesting, which is not befitting. Or is there not convenient? Okay. Befitting. It doesn't fit. It's just not appropriate for Christians. So we just need to be careful. All right, let's go ahead and turn to page 4 then and just finish up the tongue now with this last statement. Which I don't have the verse here, but it's the same concept that can you get a fig tree to bear olives? Can you get any fruit tree to bear anything but what has been created to bear? And see, that's the problem. The tongue is the fruit of the heart. And if you've got a good heart, Jesus said, out of the abundance of the heart, Mouth speaks. The good man, out of the good treasure of his heart. Matter of fact, he even makes that point. Look at this last verse there, just above James 3, 13 through 18, that Luke 6, it says, a good tree does not bear bad fruit, nor does a bad tree bear good fruit. For every tree is known by its own fruit. For men do not gather figs from thorns, nor do they gather grapes from a bramble bush. A good man, out of the good treasure of his heart, brings forth good. And an evil man out of the evil treasure of his heart brings forth evil, for out of the abundance of the heart his mouth speaks. So every time you open your mouth, you're betraying or revealing or showing, bringing into the light of day what's in your heart. And it can be embarrassing. And sometimes we embarrass ourselves among our brethren and we don't even know it. Because if our brethren, as I've mentioned so many times, if you have a weakness that I don't have, then when you expose your weakness, what's my first thought? Man, that stinks. That really stinks. Now, if I have your weakness, what does it smell like? Well, that doesn't smell so bad. That's not. I mean, this is part of our culture. But if it's not part of us, it stinks. And that's Jesus' point here, is that if you've got stench in your heart, where should you leave it? Try to leave it in your heart. Don't let it come out in the light of day. Don't shame yourself. Don't bring it up. And so the tongue, again, the most dangerous member. Don't think, as James said in chapter 1, if you don't bridle your tongue, your entire Christian religion is what? It's vain. So don't think that you are a godly, devout Christian if you can't bridle your tongue, because what did James just say? Your religion is vain. And now he's gone through it, he's explained it all. So we'll go ahead and stop there, and let's go ahead and pick up then on the middle of page 4, where we're going to pick up in James chapter 3. And one of the points that I make there, let me just read this first paragraph under James 3. It says, after James completes his discussion of the tongue, he follows the same basic theme with the wisdom and the knowledge that's in our heart. There are two distinct wisdoms found within our heart. One came from the source that Peter describes. Now let's look at these four points that Peter makes. First of all, where did our aimless conduct come from? It came from, by tradition, from our fathers. Now, most of us who grew up in the world, we became very wise in the aimless conduct from our fathers. We're just really good at it. We are really good. Like I said earlier, I'm really good at joking and cutting people. You say, Alan, what are you really good at? Well, I can really do that. Well, but guess what? I don't do it because it's worthless. It's part of the aimless conduct. Now, look at the next one. Laying aside all malice, all deceit, all hypocrisy, all envy, and all evil speaking. Is hypocrisy an art? Is it an art to be able to deceive people into thinking you're something you're not, so you can swindle them or so you can get what you want to get from them? Man, there are some people out there that are, what do we call them? Con artists. Yes. What does that mean?
Expert liars.
They are an expert in making you a fool and taking things from you. Well, is when I become a Christian, I bring that into the church. What are you good at? Oh, man, I'm a con artist. Well, guess what? That's all going to get wasted. You going to be able to use that? That's not going to be any good for you. And so the same thing with malice. There are people out there who are experts at destroying people, and they never even know it. I'm going to get you, but you won't know it. I'll be your friend the whole time, but your life is going to be destroyed, and I'm going to destroy it. Well, that's not something to be good at. Envy, evil speaking. Then the next verse, abstain from fleshly lust, which war against the soul. But again, most of us are experts. Some people are experts on seducing people. Some people are experts in stealing from people. Some people are experts in harming people or murdering people. But this isn't a wisdom that we want to have. And then the last verse, no longer should live the rest of his time in the flesh for the lusts of men, but for the will of God. Now again, are there experts on how to party? Are there, quote, party animals out there? Man, I am really good at partying. You get me drunk and I'll be the life of the party. Well, I'm going to bring that into the church. What's the church going to say? Nope. Ah, that was not going to do you any good. So when he talks about verse 13, who is wise and understanding among you? All right. Now, again, these are, Greek terms, like that other one we talked about, destiny and fate. This is a Greek term. Let's look at the definitions at the bottom of page 4. The sophos, from which we get sophistry, is one of the uses of this term, but it meant a skilled expert. And then here's some of the examples. Skilled in letters, cultivated, learned, wise in a practical sense, one whose action is governed by piety and integrity. That, of course, would be the scriptural use of it. But did some of these people come into the church? What about Simon Bar-Jesus? Was he pretty good at deceiving people? Or Simon the sorcerer? Were they pretty good at that? Well, what did Peter say? I mean, Simon just wanted to add to his collection with the ability to lay hands on people and give them the Holy Spirit so he could make even more money. And what did Peter say? Your silver perish with you. This is the wisdom that's going to do you any good. So the second definition, properly skilled in any handicraft or art, cunning in his craft, of a charioteer, of poets and musicians, of a soothsayer. Then number two, clever in matters of common life, wise, prudent, shrewd. But like I said, in what? What are the things that give us self-esteem, and what had to happen to them after we became a Christian? Now, I'm going to skip that third definition, although it's an interesting one. You would probably enjoy reading it. But the point is, all of us, if you have any self-esteem at all, what's it based on? I mean, if you feel like you are as good as anyone else in this room, what do you have to be able to do that? Because some people with low self-esteem, they see what other people can do, and what do they say? I can't do anything. Well, most of us have worked really hard to get to be good at something. And when he asks that question, who is wise? That's what he's asking. What gives you your self-esteem? What gives you wisdom? Now, back in Romans, 1 Corinthians chapter 2, Paul has to, or chapter 1, and actually 1 through 3, he has to hammer on the Corinthians because they're so wise that what? Yeah, Paul said, if you think you're wise, you need to become a fool so you can become wise. And that's really, I think, the genre of what we're dealing with here, is that in some areas of our wisdom, what's the smartest thing we can do? Just see it all as folly, throw it all away, and start over again. There are some things that just can't be recycled. There are some things that just can't be, I was really good at this in the world, and now I'm going to try to use this in the church. Well, if you're a con artist, how are you going to use that in the church? There's no way to use it. So the point is, what are you wise at? And does your wisdom, hang on a second, Virgil, does your wisdom really reflect what you're wanting it to reflect? Virgil?
A truly a wise man will look with the attitude that what I know is a very little of what I want to be. I'm not the smartest person in the world.
Yeah, but that doesn't come until you're in your 60s, I think. I don't think you could teach a 20-year-old that. Hopefully you could. But see, this is James, where James is going is, this wisdom is not from above. This is earthly, devilish, sensual. This wisdom is from above. Now, that's where we're heading. And so we got these two wisdoms, and of course I got to get into the next term, which is knowledge or intelligence. And we'll pick up with that next week. And we'll go ahead and delve into this, because I think this is critical. We really need to do a self-evaluation. What am I good at, and how many of the things that still give me self-esteem are things that God would love if I just flush them down the toilet? They shouldn't be giving me self-esteem at all. But and some people have all sorts of things that they're really good at, and yet they need to forget how to do them. All right, we'll go ahead and stop there, and then we'll pick up next week with, I guess we're just going to have to start with verse 14, and then we'll come into the next section. Thanks, everybody.